One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai. Kosai.org.
Merkle Media.
Oh, Ashback Fridays here on Macroaggressions. We're going back to November 11th, 2020. Episode number 72, The Red Dragon versus Uncle Sam. If you're interested in converting some of your soon-to-be hyperinflated and worthless fiat currency into tangible precious metals, go to the website www.macroaggressions.gold. Talk to Tony Arterburn, our partner over there. He'll sort you out. Also, if you have a retirement account that you want to convert into precious metals, he's your guy. Now, please enjoy the show.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Keith Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a Perdita!
Swangled in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, Macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. Thanks for checking us out. I know you have a million choices out there, so I certainly do appreciate you finding this podcast and hopefully sharing it with your friends and family or subscribing and writing a review, whatever. Let's game the algorithms. We know that they're working against us and trying to suppress this information, but we also know that things like subscribing and giving 5 stars and writing reviews helps to boost podcasts. So maybe with everybody's help, we can make this go mainstream and then a bunch of normies will check out this podcast and will be horrified at the sorts of things that they learn that we've all known for quite a while. One of the things that has been, you know, it's been a big story for a long time now, and that is the role of China in this global play that we're all participants in. And China is an interesting place. I've been there a couple of times. It's weird. I mean, that's just the best way to, I'm not trying to be offensive to Chinese people. It's definitely, and I would also suggest that if they came from mainland China and came to the United States, they would classify us as weird as well. So I'm not trying to make any sort of distinction that they're more weird than we are, but it's just a different version of weird. For instance, if you like scorpions on a stick, then you're in luck when you go to China, because you can walk down the street and see, instead of a hot dog cart like you might find in New York City, you will find a scorpion on a stick cart, and you can just eat those till you're all full, which in my case would be never. I think I ate at California Pizza Kitchen just about every single day I was in China, when I was in Shanghai, at least, because I'm a stupid American who's terrified of unusual food. But that's just me. Anyway, the people are really nice. I mean, I don't have an issue with the Chinese people. Their government, on the other hand, it's just a different form of government. And I'm not even really necessarily saying that it's any worse than ours, because at least with China, there's no pretext that they have some sort of democracy or republic or whatever version of government you think you have in the United States, which we really don't. But China doesn't they don't play around. But, you know, for better or worse, they don't play around. And the government is an authoritarian, top-down regime. Now, we, as American citizens, I can only speak for myself, we look at that type of government and we're, horrified by it. It goes against everything that we sort of believe in. We are of the belief that, it's better to be free. We're individuals need to make their own decisions. And, control from authoritarian state doesn't really work for us. Now, let me just preface that comment by saying that's what we believe we're living in. We believe that we've got all these rights and all these, the ability to do things. Oh, we vote, it matters. I mean, the truth of that situation in the United States is that we're not as free as we think we are. But anyway, the concept is we believe that our version of government is much better than China's version of government, because at least we have a voice, and in their case, they do not. Well, China is about getting things done. They don't care what you think about the way they go about doing things. They're just about getting things done. That can work wonders, and that can also be a gigantic environmental or societal problem. So when the coronavirus sweeps through China, they decide that they're going to combat that by building hospitals, and they build a couple massive hospitals in like 15 days. And we look at that and we go, that building's going to come down. Where's the building inspectors for that? China just runs differently. They just see the world differently. They have, I worked in real estate for a very long time, still do. And I sold a condo, a mid-rise condo project. And one of the people I sold to was a husband and wife. The husband was a white American, and the wife was from mainland China, and they were living in the United States, Las Vegas specifically. And they'd already moved into the condo they bought from me, and they would just come and hang out in my sales office, and we would chat from time to time. And one of the things I would ask her about specifically, they both lived in China for a long time, and she obviously grew up there. I would just ask them about like their culture and that sort of the things that are different. She said, well, as an example, if you're on a motorcycle and you get hit by a car, pedestrians, onlookers, witnesses, they don't really rush to the aid of the person on the motorcycle that's been hit by the car. They just kind of look at them and go about their own life, just keep walking and do whatever. Every now and then, they'll drag the guy off, maybe out of the street, but they're not going to render any aid. And my response was, good Lord, that sounds like barbaric and horrific. Like, why is that? And her response to me was, I'll never forget it. She says, well, because there's just so many of us that we don't have to worry if one guy gets hit by a motorcycle. And I was like, wow, that is a crazy way of seeing the world. Like, what if that was your family member that got hit by a car? It's like, well, So they do things differently. And they view their citizens, the government views the citizens, not with any sort of love, just as kind of like a colony of ants that they have to manage. And the people also see themselves as just, more ants. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful to Chinese people by describing them as ants, but I'm just saying that they have this, there's just so many And they are all trying to, they're, you know, in some ways they're working in concert. And it's an interesting culture. It's a culture that does not really praise the individual. It really works to glorify the group as a whole, as opposed to individuality. And that's fine. It's just a different way of doing things. I'm not even necessarily saying that that is the wrong way to do it. I wouldn't want to live there and I wouldn't want to participate in that. But, you know, look, there's all sorts of ways to run your society. And certainly the American government, the American version of running society has a ton of flaws in it, obviously. So it's not as if we're in some real position to lecture people on how best to run their government. But with regard to China, it's pretty obvious that it is real different. Just the way the government views the people are terrified of the government, as they probably should be. And the culture, doesn't place, you know, it's just different. It's different even by Asian cultural standards too. I mean, the way China runs is very different from the way that, Japan runs their culture. So, this is not to be a critique of China and to say that they need to get their act together and change and become America, because I don't think that's the solution. But this is it. Understanding what is happening inside China from a domestic policy standpoint, and also understanding their role in foreign diplomacy and what they're trying to achieve or not trying to achieve, with regard to their foreign investments and their military deployments and things like that. And then another component is how the rest of the world views China and what that means as far as developing policies in the United States, particular towards dealing with China for the next 20 plus years. So in order to understand why China does the things that they do, it's kind of important to get some sort of historical background on who they are and what they do. And this is not meant to be a full detailed analysis of Chinese history, just a small one, just so that we have a little bit of context here. So China's been around for over 4,000 years. They have a tendency, we know about the Great Wall of China. They're a culture that is more isolationist. They are really sort of focused on themselves. You don't see them overly, they're not expanding. They're not threatening their neighbors. It's not to say that they can't. I mean, it's not to say that they're not decent to the people that live inside their borders, but they're also not actively aggressive with neighboring countries. They're sort of working on their own thing. But the growth of China, both in terms of population and economy, has been nothing short of astounding. And when one considers the mess they were in after Mao's Cultural Revolution, their progress is almost unbelievable. And Mao's Cultural Revolution involved the murder of 70 million of their own people. So he was a maniac of epic proportions. And I know everybody throws around Hitler, and you're the next Hitler, and you're this, and then, you know. Listen, Hitler had nothing on Mao. Okay, you don't want to. If we want to stack up death tolls, you know, Mao is operating at anywhere from 10 to 15 times more than Adolf Hitler. But it doesn't really get. He doesn't get that kind of negative press, I guess. Hitler has bad PR. I guess. I don't know. I'm not trying to say that Hitler was a good guy or anything like that. I'm just saying that in terms of context, if we really want to rank these psychopaths in terms of how many people they murdered, Mao would be at the top of the list, because he had a long time of doing it, like 3 decades, but he also had an endless supply of people he could murder. And that was one of his, you know, greatest accomplishments, was killing so many people of his own citizens. So when Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger made China a priority for American economic development, in conjunction with Chase Bank and David Rockefeller, it took a very old country that was best known for silk, opium, an enormous wall, and transformed it into the largest factory on the planet, all in half a century. Now, part of that transformation was the realization that in order to make these drastic changes, an exodus would have to take place in which the rural population would migrate to the big cities and industrial hubs. Now, some people moved willingly and others did not. The authoritarian roots of the country still remained, so some were forcibly relocated to fill the needs in the demographic shift away from an agrarian society and into manufacturing. That's what they did. They lured people out of the farms and into the factories. And that was a shift that took time. But it's important to realize who was driving this shift. It was David Rockefeller and his involvement in China through Chase Bank. He was instrumental. He was paramount in China becoming what they were. Now the Chinese government is going to take some credit for it, obviously, and the Chinese workers and this cultural shift and all this stuff is going to get credit for it. But at its core, when David Rockefeller got involved with the opening up of China through his connections with Kissinger and Nixon, what that did was if you know David Rockefeller, who he is, how he operates, what he values in life, you would know that this was not because he wanted to save the Chinese people or he wanted to, you know, to improve upon their situation. This was purely selfish on his part. This was because he wanted to open up the cheapest possible labor he could get his hands on for the variety of industries that they control, not the least of which is the pharmaceutical industry, which makes all of our medicine in China. But beyond that, he understood that Americans with their unions and their, you know, high wages, you know, you can get a widget made anywhere. Why pay a dollar for one when you can pay a, you know, 2 cents for it? So he started this push of offshoring the manufacturing process. But before he did that, they had to make sure that the infrastructure of China was either in place or was in the process of being put in place so that this industrial revolution that he envisioned in China would take place and would actually be effective. So this process of relocation of the Chinese peasants from the fields into the factories is still happening, with trends showing even more movement towards cities and away from farms, even now. In fact, the projections are that Chinese cities will grow by 350 million people in the next decade due to a shift from rural to urban living. So think about that for 1 second, what that number signifies. As many Chinese people there'll be as many Chinese people moving from the farms to the cities in the next 10 years as Americans living in America. 350 million Chinese people will make that move. Now, you think the Chinese cities are full now? You think Beijing's pollution is out of control right now in 2020 with as many people? Wait till 350 million more people move, the equivalent to the entire population of the United States, moving into Chinese cities. By 2025, China will build 5 million additional buildings. That's in the next 5 years. In the next 5 years, China will build 5 million additional buildings. That's 1 million buildings a year, including 50,000 high-rises. I was in Shanghai at the rooftop deck of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel where we were staying, which surprisingly was very affordable. When you go to that rooftop deck and you look in all four directions, it's just high-rise buildings as far as you can see. You can't see it. There's no end to it. If you go to a high, you know, you get to the top of like the observation deck of, you know, a prominent building in New York City, you could see New Jersey. You can, you know, you could see the water. You can see the Statue of Liberty. You could see things as far as you can see in Shanghai, you could not see the end of the high rises. It's got a real weird feel to it. Very dystopian, very Blade Runner-ish, you know, just not, you know, it's very cold. And so to think that 50,000 more high rises are going up in China just in the next 5 years is, you know, hard to imagine. But then again, once you see it, and you see how fast they put hospitals up. So these high rises, they go up relatively quickly. China currently has 64 million empty homes, as well as entire cities that are vacant. You've seen the ghost cities of China. You have to have seen those. Now, someone like me that has worked for developers for a decade plus, it's unimaginable. You know, the way they do things is totally backwards from the way a traditional developer would do it. There, you know, a developer in the United States is measuring things like, how much money do I have? How much demand is there? What can I get this land for? How much is the infrastructure going to cost? How long is this going to take to go through all the approvals with the city and county and state and all this stuff? And then once we start building, boy, you know, I hope we lock in our construction costs, but what if things happen to change and what if demand falls off a cliff and the real estate market was great when we started this project, but God, by the time it took us 3 years to build it all out, then, you know, the market turned and we have to worry about demand. They don't have to worry about any of this shit in China. They just build. They take the money that the government gives them to these developers and they just build. They worry about none of that. They don't worry about regulations and restrictions and guidelines and all this stuff. I mean, there's minor ones in place. It's like, hey, build the building so they don't fall over. But I mean, they're not going to get hung up on the fact that, oh, maybe we're developing this piece of land that had an endangered tortoise on it, like we used to have to deal with in Las Vegas. They would say, endangered tortoise? That sounds delicious. Let's find as many as we can and then build a new high rise over their home. You know, they don't give a shit about that stuff. So to build entire ghost cities and the amount of cost that goes into that and the amount of constant maintenance that has to happen or else they fall apart. It's weird to me, but it's a normal way of doing things in China. Now, when I look at something, a project like that, the first thing that goes through my mind when you're talking about empty cities that were built far away from other cities that have no functioning sort of purpose or manufacture, there's no people there. There's no people wanting to live there. The first thing that goes through my mind is money laundering, because that's how you would do it. If you really wanted to launder money, you'd be building projects that, you know, may or may not have demand. But China has a plan. It's a different plan, but it's, you know, it's part of 350 million people in the next decade shifting up from the rural to urban living. Well, they're going to need places to live. So they build out these ghost cities and they have 64 million empty homes sitting there. Well, they're expecting people. So on the surface, this looks insane, but if you take a look at it from a central planning standpoint, they're just getting ahead of the curve. They're giving, you know, they're enticing these people. If they want to get them to move from the farms to the factories, they've got to provide them with a place to live. Or they could just do what San Francisco does, which is just tell everyone the rents are too high and you can sleep on the floor and shit on the sidewalk, you know? Go with that, you know, go with that strategy. But China's massive and their development is unbelievable. They consume 53% of the world's cement. Think about that. And as well as half of the world's iron ore and coal. So while we talk about these coal burning plants and things like that, I'm like, oh, if only we could get our legislators here in the United States to move away from the coal burning plant. That's nice. That's great. You should probably do that. But don't forget that half of, you know, for every coal-fired power plant you've got in the United States, who knows how many more there are in China? 100 more? You know, they've got half of them. They use half the world's coal. So, you know, if you want to crack down on, you know, pollution, but you're leaving China out of the equation, then you're not really doing anything. But I digress. Anyway, so it's just that China has a different way of seeing things. They're planning this new army of people coming to the city, and they will only be planning that if they had a legitimate reason for them to come there. They had something for them. Well, like I said, they are and plan to continue to be the largest manufacturing facility in the world. China is, you know, is, you can do it cheaper. You can do it without regulations. They've got the infrastructure set up. It's all there for you. The problem is you have a cultural component that is incongruent with the American way of doing business and also just the American lifestyle. So, i.e., China will take, America wants to build something in China that requires some form of intellectual property. If they do that and have it built with Chinese labor, the Chinese will take that intellectual property and steal it. They just will. It's not even really like, you know, it's just the way they are. They'll do that. They'll take it and make knockoffs of it, or you know, or build it in a different way. We're all familiar with Chinese knockoffs of designer watches and things like that. Believe me, I've bought a fake watch in China, and I don't even really wear a watch, but when you get a cool looking Tag Heuer watch, or you know, some Rolex or something, and you're like, wow, $20 for that? That's what a steal. Yeah. Well, good luck, you know, having that thing last until you, one of the guys I was with the first time I was in China was wearing his, and just, it just spontaneously just fell apart while we were walking down the street, just came totally apart and just fell off of his wrist. I mean, they don't build them very well. This is China. That's kind of what they do. It's actually also kind of fun to go shopping in those markets, because then they're like, hey, you want to go upstairs and see the good stuff? And you're like, oh, fuck yeah, I want to go see the good stuff. And they're like, cool, let's take you down some back stairway, up two flights of stairs. And then it's like something straight out of a movie where the person like does the buzzer, and then you hear the speaker, who is it? And you know, you got to give them the password and everything. And then they open up this vault-like door, and you walk in, and it's just Louis Vuitton purses all the way to the ceiling, and Hugo Boss sunglasses, and all this fake stuff. And it's all made there. It's like, you know, it's black market or gray market, but that's kind of a cultural thing in China. They're going to take your intellectual property and they're going to make copies of it. Deal with it or don't, you know, don't get it made there if you don't want that to happen. But the United States, from a cultural standpoint, they see China as being just a little bit too authoritarian and a little bit too controlling of their people. Now, in light of the current coronavirus situation that has unfolded inside the United States, we're less free from the authoritarian rule of our government than we might like to believe we are. So we're not too far off from China. But one of the things it does is it draws this sort of question of what is the role of the United States and China in the future? Can they peacefully exist together? And unfortunately, the answer to that 75% of the time is no. And why do I say 75% of the time? It's a pretty specific number. Well, I'll tell you why. There is a concept called the Thucydides trap. And this is the theory that it comes from Greek historian Thucydides. But it's a theory that as one superpower fades and another rises, the chance of war between the two powers is a very likely outcome, perhaps inevitable. And the Greek historian Thucydides first understood this idea, framed in the context of the demise of Sparta, just as Athens was becoming, was beginning its ascension to the top of the power structure. And the quote was, "It was the rise of Athens and the fear that this instilled in Sparta that made war inevitable." So as the most populous country the world has ever known begins to surpass the wealthiest country, will the fear of loss trigger the war of wars between two nations capable of ending life on this planet? Or can sanity be injected into this situation? But I would, you know, I would suggest that much like a humiliated drunk, America is a danger to itself and those close to it, because it is liable to just start throwing punches and at those people that are pointing and laughing. And America's behavior over the last 50 years has really tarnished its reputation around the world. And I think there are a lot of countries, many countries, that would love to see the United States get a dose of its own medicine. So in the past 500 years, there have been 16 cases in which a rising power threatened to displace a ruling one. And 75% of the time, it ended in war. That's where that number comes from. So as China challenges America's predominance, misunderstandings about intentions, differences in monetary systems, or a desire to ditch the petrodollar may very well lead them into a deadly conflict. The encirclement of China by the United States' string of military bases already shows a potentially hostile intent on the part of America, as America hypocritically complains about China building islands in their own waters, you know, to counter that threat. It's like, oh, they're building in the East China Sea. And you're like, well, what do you expect? And America acts like, oh, well, we can't have that. They're threatening us. Like, well, we're the ones that are close to their country. And we're talking about, it's preposterous, as you all know. But see, China's been making major moves to partner with Africa rather than colonizing it. The American way is proving to be less about loving thy neighbor and more about subjugating him. Now the British, they exploited the Dark Continent for diamonds, land, natural resources, raw material, and even people. In South Africa, under British rule, designed a cultural system of racism through apartheid. Belgium and France pilfered their resources and slaughtered their people. In fact, King Leopold II of Belgium was responsible for the murdering of 10 million Congolese. That never gets talked about. Where's he on the list? He's ahead of Hitler. Where's he? The United States has blown up countries like Libya and Somalia and built military bases and others like Djibouti. I mean, the United States and China, their conflict may very well come to a head in Africa. China builds hospitals for sick Africans instead of graveyards for dead ones. And Africans remember this. Now, it's not to say that China is there to be some, you know, saint and come and save everyone in Africa. No doubt they are seeking to exploit them as well, because they have, you know, they're looking to use them. They need them. And so they have gone about it in a much different way than the United States has, which is China looks at Africa and says, let's partner up. We'll bring the money. You bring the resources. We'll work together. America says, that's a nice country you've got there. It'd be a shame if something bad happened to it, and threatens them. You know, that's our way of dealing with countries like that. So in 2016, America invested $3.6 billion in Africa. China invested $36.1 billion, more than all the other countries in the world combined. And China is the second largest provider and the top receiver of foreign direct investment. So, but just to put the Chinese population, we talk about how many people there are in China. Oh, there's over a billion people, billion and a half people. Think of it this way. If you really want to kind of wrap your head around the population of China, their population is equal to North America, South America, Western Europe, Australia, and New Zealand combined. That's a lot of people. They can do a whole lot with that. And you know what they choose to do with all the people that live in their country? Educate them. They spend more on education and training as a percentage of gross domestic product than any country in the world, right around 4%. And its education system is the largest one in the world. There are more Chinese university students than in both the United States and Western Europe combined. So they are educating their people, not with this bullshit Common Core stuff, like real education. And then sending them off to universities, you know, a lot of them outside of China, to get a, you know, even more of an education. And then they come back. And then who builds these factories? Who runs these factories? You know, who's involved in that? They've put together a great educational system. The One Belt, One Road plan to connect Europe and Asia, in conjunction with the rise of cryptocurrencies, is setting the stage for a major global disruption and paradigm shift away from taxes, tariffs, and threats, which is the United States way, into open markets, sound money, and cooperative trade through multiple continents. Kind of the way we should be going. But we're not. We're into tariffs, and we're into, you know, threatening countries as opposed to directly investing and working with them. And look, the United States should be feeling threatened by these new developments. Not because they actually fear China, but because China's making them look bad by comparison. You know, look, it's not to say that China is without their problems or a checkered past. You know, remember, they're only six decades removed from their leader rounding up and executing 73 million of their own people again. So let's not pretend that there's some, you know, government system that's looking out for the people. But they're about making money. They're about they're about leveraging the manufacturing stranglehold they have, taking that and using that leverage to partner with other countries, continents like Africa that they had no interest in before, but now they do. And so what does that create? What happens when you start to recognize this? Well, in the case of America, you start to see the media demonizing China. And I did a podcast with Robbie Martin from Media Roots, and he is, we're in agreement on this, that you're seeing the rise of these neocon psychos, that the Project for a New American Century bunch of maniacs that were all, you know, all had boners for the Middle East and how, you know, we've got to rebuild America's defenses, right? And all that nonsense, and getting into these overseas wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and if it was up to them, Iran and Syria and Libya and you name it. So those guys, those neocon guys, they've now set their sights on China, and you start to hear it coming out. You start to hear from assholes like Bill Kristol, and that this push to demonize China. And China's got their own problems. So let me, you know, to be clear, for like the sixth time in this podcast, I'm not trying to say that China has it all figured out or that they treat their people well. I don't think they do. But the American corporate media has begun the push to sell the population that the new threat to freedom and democracy is China, as the United States government simultaneously sells them trillions of dollars of sovereign debt to finance the Ponzi scheme the Federal Reserve has been running for over 100 years. But, you know, but they're the threat. China's, you know, coming to get us. But China's always been there. This isn't some new threat. They didn't come down from Zeta Reticuli and start a civilization a decade ago. They've been right where they always have been for the last 36 centuries. They never pushed into Europe. They never tried to colonize India. They didn't ship all their prisoners to Australia. Great Britain did. They did all those things. China didn't. The Christian roots of the United States and Great Britain make them countries seeking to convert other people or countries to their way of thinking. In comparison, the Chinese built the Great Wall 2,000 years ago to keep the invaders out. So it is not in their culture to seek to expand and conquer the way some Western nations do. So that's part of the reason why it's incongruent. The Western way of doing things and the Chinese way of doing things, they don't necessarily work together because they come from two fundamentally different ways of viewing the world. The United States views the world from an expansionist standpoint, where they want to go out there and capture all these countries and make that, you know, make them work for them, not under the United States flag necessarily, but just make them captured states, captured countries, captured industries. And they do that a variety of ways. And Great Britain did this for a long, long time. You know, you look at their control of India and South Africa, you know, and so they have a tendency to get out there in the Caribbean islands, of course, there's tons of them there. They have a tendency to overtly control them and then plant their flag. China doesn't do that. China minds their own business. They keep to themselves. They want everybody to stay the fuck out of their country as much as possible, which is why they built the wall. So, you know, so if a country's economy depends on military spending, like the United States, then that country must always have an enemy to justify the expenditures of weapons and intelligence gathering and military bases. You know, but if your country is the United States and your economy is as bloated and wasteful as it's been for the past half century, then the military-industrial complex must have multiple enemies spread throughout the world to justify 800 military bases in 70 countries and their trillion-dollar defense budget. So, is China a threat to the United States? Well, the Obama administration certainly seemed to think so, with his announcement of a pivot to Asia and the relocation of 2/3 of the American naval fleet to positions in close proximity to China as a result of their construction of airstrips in the South China Sea and the, you know, on the disputed Spratly Island chain. So, whether China is actually a threat to the United States is almost of little consequence, because the United States is going to pretend that they are a threat because they have to justify the military-industrial complex's greed and desire to you know, justify its $1 trillion of budget that it gets every year. So they're going to play this up. You know, it's why the Obama administration thought they were in any position to tell China what they can do in the South China Sea. Not the South American Sea, the South China Sea. It's just another example of the arrogance of American foreign policy. Like, if China was building airstrips on Catalina Island, 26 miles off the coast of Los Angeles, then a response would be warranted and expected. But, you know, whether they're actually a military threat is irrelevant, because they will be portrayed as a military threat simply because of the way the American media and weapons industries are interconnected. The weapons makers need an enemy. The media needs life-threatening events to prop up their crappy ratings. And the mega conglomerates like GE that own, you know, the largest players in both of these industries, you know, they see a situation like this as a two-for-one opportunity to make huge profits, owning military-industrial complex companies, owning media companies. What could be better? What's the best thing for them? War. It's not peace. Remember that Megadeth album, Peace Sells, But Who's Buying? That just pretty much summed up America right there. But the more realistic threat from China comes from an economic weapon, not necessarily a military one. They hold trillions of dollars worth of American debt, and they are the biggest manufacturer and exporter of the cheap goods that America depends on. So the way this relationship has been operating is that America spends their dollars to buy cheap Chinese products and have them shipped to the United States. China then takes those dollars that were used to buy their cheap goods, and they buy America's debt in the form of treasury notes that pay interest to the holder. It creates a cycle that turns you know, sheets of paper into United States dollars that are used to buy products, then those dollars are used to buy an investment in American debt. And this scam allows the United States to generate money out of thin air and then turn it into tangible products. And American consumers get cheap Chinese products and incoming investment capital. So the average American actually benefits from foreigners providing cheap services and only demanding pieces of paper in return. It's a great scam that America's pulled. It's amazing. But China's going to figure it out, and they have figured it out. But the problem is they're sitting on so much of our debt that if they decide to attack us, it's one of those things. It's like you're only hurting yourself by doing it. If they decide to tank our economy, they just have to acknowledge the fact that they're holding a lot of the debt from our economy. So to do that would have ramifications for them as well, that they might not want to go down that path. But they have the ability to do that. And I think it's always important for us to remember that before we start picking a war with China, we're kind of dependent on them. We're dependent on them for manufacturing. We're dependent on them for all of our medicines that are made over there. We're dependent on them to buy our shitty debt that no one else wants. They're not even buying it for the most part anymore. The Fed is buying their own debt. So it's turning into an unsustainable Ponzi scheme here with the way we've cooked our Federal Reserve notes and tried to force them onto people. But the current trade arrangement is not balanced. You know, it's fairly lopsided. The U.S. exports to China were only $130 billion, while the imports from China were over $500 billion. So we're at a huge trade inequality here. China's population is four times the size of America's population. Yet their economy is growing at triple the rate of the United States. So they're four times bigger than us, and they're growing three times faster. Their economy is. They export more than they import, while the United States imports more than they export. You know, it doesn't take a genius to understand where this is going. And they were the largest economy in the world in 1820. And they are expected, at the rate they're going right now, they are expected to reclaim that position by 2030. And what's interesting about the whole thing is that when you look at China and you look at this authoritarian top-down regime that controls everything, what you would expect is you would expect that the government sector would be responsible for all of this, for fueling their economy. And it's actually the exact opposite. The private sector in China is responsible for 80% of the growth and employment. So they're an interesting group. You know, it's communist China, but not totally, because they have a very thriving private sector. A private sector that's responsible for four out of the five components of growth, right? 80% of the growth is fueled by them. So the government's in charge, but there's also a private sector as well. And what it's turning into is that if you're running businesses in the private sector of China, you answer to the government. You have to kind of keep yourself in a good relationship with the government because they can shut you off if they want to. So you're private, but you're sort of semi-private. You still rely on the government for a lot of things. But really, how is that much different from what we're experiencing in the United States right now? There's a massive private sector. But the ones that are really doing well, the companies that are really, they're all in bed with the government in a similar way that they are in China. So we're moving towards this Chinese model while we're screaming about how horrible the Chinese model is. The number of households in China with an annual disposable income above 10,000 is scheduled to quadruple to 222 million. They're moving into a different segment of the economy when you've got 222 million people that have more and more disposable income to spend. China was, you know, it was always thought of as like peasant farmers and people working at Foxconn making, you know, 75 cents an hour, or, you know, putting buttons on circuit boards and hoping that they don't jump off the building into the, you know, the suicide nets have been constructed there because it's, you know, nobody wants to work for Foxconn. I mean, there's that. And that's a component of it, but they're about to have a massive middle class. And what does that mean? So things are going to change in China. It's only a matter of time. So in the event China decided they wanted to put the United States into a financial recession or depression, you know, it'd be a done deal. Within the span of a week, all they'd have to do is stop buying American debt. And the world would see that the largest economy in the history of the planet is really a house of cards held together by like an implied trust in a fiat currency backed by nothing of substance, you know, except a dangerous military, of course, and built on a foundation of quicksand. That's the U.S. dollar in a nutshell. Now, the reason why this isn't a situation worth really worrying about is that China would be committing investment suicide if they destroyed the reputation of the United States. The Chinese need the U.S. to continue to function so that all the American treasuries that they currently own, estimated to be, you know, over $1 trillion of them, retain their value. And also so that America is able to continue to make their interest payments on these treasuries that China holds. They want to get something for it. So, you know, it's kind of like when you loan money to some guy who owes you money and is like, I'm going to pay you, and he's making you small payments. You know, he stole money from you and you're like, I can go to the police. Well, if you go to the police and put that guy in jail, you're not going to get paid. You know that. So it's almost in your best interest to keep this guy going so that you get some payments. We're like this deadbeat, you know, that keeps saying we're going to give you your money late. Well, you want to make sure that person is in a position to keep getting you your money, even if you have a huge problem with the way the guy acts. And that's kind of the way that China and the United States works. Like, China sort of needs the United States. They don't like them. They don't like the way the U.S. conducts business, but they need them to still be there because they're so dependent on them. So it's in China's best interest to keep America in the game. Because if they go down, they will be dragging a sizable chunk of Chinese assets down with them. And I think it would be fair to characterize the relationship that the United States and China have as a host-parasite relationship. Because really, if one goes down, they both go down. And China's lack of aggression in this field is less about weakness and more about being strategic and about self-preservation. So, you know, our economies are intertwined in a way that is impossible to separate them from one another. So we kind of have to deal with each other. Now, one of the scary components of China, you know, and there are a few, And it's par for the course when you have a type of top-down control grid that China has, is that their venture into tracking from a technological standpoint everything that's happening in their country in a social credit system is to me the most alarming component of this, because China is taking 1984 to a whole new level. And the United States is looking at China and saying, oh, that's how you do it right there. That's the blueprint for global enslavement. We like that. Now, they'll tell us, oh, it's terrible what China's doing. But in private, they would say, China's got the right idea. You know why they think that? Because they don't have to worry about getting pushback from the people in China, because the government just steamrolls them and just says, this is what we're doing and we're doing it. And they've trained the Chinese people to not really fight back. you know, you just don't. The United States, we still have a little bit of fight left in us, though it's draining out daily. But this social credit system that they have erected in China is fucking alarming. And anybody that is unfamiliar with this, I've done a couple, oh boy. I mean, I've done a couple episodes where I've talked about this on other people's shows. But it's worth mentioning again, just so you know, this is a scenario that is very real in Shenzhen, China, which has been the test market for this. Facial recognition cameras everywhere. And I mean everywhere. They've already sold 300 million facial recognition cameras in China alone. And I'm talking the facial, I'm not talking about just the regular cameras, the CCTV cameras. There's billions of those. But just the facial recognition cameras, 300 million in China already. And what they'll do is they map you, you know, you walk down the street, you get on a train. When you're on the train, cameras in the train, matching up your face, you do something that goes against the law, smoking a cigarette as an example. Start smoking on that train. It only takes a couple minutes before the train facial recognition cameras map out who you are. They associate you with your cell phone that you have in your pocket. They connect to your Weibo account, which is like a PayPal, and you are fined for your indiscretion of smoking on this train, and the fine is deducted from your account, your balance that you have on your cell phone. You're essentially like your version of PayPal. They use a lot of QR codes, so it's a little different from the Western system of doing things, but I think you get the point. So judge, jury, and executioner, or finer in this point, you commit a violation. The computers figure out who you are. It automatically sends a fine to you that is already deducted out of your account, and that's China. And they keep track of who you are and where you go and what you buy and who you associate with. So if you're the same, let's use the same smoker guy. This smoker guy, I like him already. Not because he smokes, but just because he's given the finger to the authorities, right? So he gets off this train, right? And he's been fined for this. Now, this fine will affect his social credit score. The way that he is portrayed as a good citizen to China. It goes down a little bit. His score does. Think of it like your credit score. Goes up, goes down. It's always fluid. And so this poor bastard has had his credit score reduced a little bit because of his indiscretion. Now, let's say that his friend decides to call him up and talk to him for a little bit. And his friend's a good guy, right? Goes to work every day, doesn't smoke on trains, you know. Decent guy. Now, this friend who called him and had this conversation, the friend's credit score goes down now because it's guilt by association, because he's associating with a guy who's got a lower score. So now this poor guy who was just minding his own business, getting on the phone, calling his buddy, the smoker, this guy's like, my score went down. Oh no, my score went down from talking to the smoker guy. Well, I can't talk to him anymore because I don't want my score to go down. Because if my score goes down too low, guess what happens? Can't get on that train ever anymore. Can't get on an airplane. If your score is too low, they shut off your travel restrictions. They shut off your travel ability by putting restrictions on you. That's a real thing. So now think about it this way. If you're listening to this, if you're listening to me rant like a lunatic on these podcasts, which thank you very much. I appreciate you listening, by the way. And the types of topics that we get into, your score would go down just by being associated with this podcast. And so then it becomes self-policing, where I start to make decisions, you know, the person starts to make decisions based on, you know, I really want to call my buddy the smoker, but geez, I just don't want my score to go down anymore. So I won't do it. And then that becomes, you know, the way society works. It's you're punished. Like all of a sudden your phone stops ringing from all your friends because your score is too low and they don't want to be associated with you. Not because they don't like you. They do like you. They're your friends. But man, it's like, I just can't have my score go down anymore. I mean, you know, I got to have my, so what does the score up and down mean? What is it? Well, we talked about how it will, in some cases, restrict your travel ability. That's a big one. But consequentially, if you have a high score, then offers are made to you that not everybody gets. So if you're if you need to rent a scooter to get around, you've gone to a new city, you need to rent a scooter and get around. Well, if you have a high enough score, that scooter is discounted to you. Might even be free in some cases. So you go to the store and the medicine you want, well, the medicine's got a little bit of a discount on it, you know, for our valued customer. Think about like your, you know, you get like a grocery store card, you know, you scan when you go through the groceries. And then if you buy enough stuff, hey, guess what? I got a little discount, or I got a discount on my gasoline purchases because of that. That's here in the United States. We do that. That's cool. Well, in this case, if you have your score high enough, your social credit score, you might get a discount on your groceries. So there's a financial incentive to keeping your score high. And how do you keep your score high? You keep it high by not letting it get low. How does it get low? By associating with these dirty people, these people that with low credit scores. So think about that component to it. Now, the United States is watching this and they are salivating over this opportunity to control the population. And when you understand the social credit system that is in China now is being exported to other countries, it's being exported to parts of Ecuador already, among other countries, and it is most definitely coming to the United States. Then you think about all of the restrictions and rules that were put in place during the coronavirus situation. And you go, oh, wow, this has got a little social credit score feel to it as well. Wearing your mask, good, your score goes up. Not wearing your mask, walking into a grocery store with facial recognition cameras to go shopping and buy this toilet paper that you need, but you don't have your mask on, score goes down. Complaining about it on Facebook, score goes down. You know, refusing the vaccine, travel restrictions applied. You see how this works? You see where this is going? Now, it sounds, like I said, it sounds like this is some dystopian future. It's dystopian, all right, but it's not in the future. The future's now with this stuff. It is actively happening. China's the test market, you know, because they don't have to ask the people for permission to run a test on them. They just do it. So that's happened in China, currently happening, and that system will be exported. So do we have to worry about China? Well, we have to worry about some of their ways of doing things being adopted by Americans, by the American government, and being pushed out to the people as the, you know, as the right way to do things. Boy, I just don't like the idea of the social credit system. And as we sit in 2020 here, I also acknowledge that it's coming. And we think we'll stand up to it. We think we'll say, oh, I'm not going to allow that. They have ways to make you comply, man. They will tie it to your driver's license, tie it to your social security card, tie it to your, you know, don't get your vaccines. Oh, your kid doesn't get to go to school. All right. You know, it's on your social credit system as vaccine hesitant or a vaccine refuser, something like that. Well, but I got to get on a plane and go to Buffalo because I got a sales meeting. Oh, no, 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 no planes for you, buddy. You see here, it says that you haven't taken the vaccine. And therefore you're put in this new category, which is do not travel, and you can't get on. It sucks. I don't like this. I don't like to think of it. But this doesn't even require you putting on your detective's hat or your tinfoil hat to see where this is going, because it's pretty clear to anybody that's paying attention. So when people talk about China being a threat to the United States, that's true in some aspects, but maybe not the way that the media would have you thinking about it. The media and the government and the military industrial complex, they want you to view China as the aggressor. That yes, you have to fear China because they are coming to get you and they're going to, you know, take over this country and they're going to kill you all, right? That's how they think about it. Those aren't realistic fears. If you want to worry about China, there's plenty to worry about, but it's more about the ideas that China has embraced being exported to the United States, and that the United States government would see those ideas, and instead of saying, absolutely not, under no circumstances do we want anything resembling that to happen in our country, unfortunately, what you're starting to see is they're looking at China and saying, these people have figured out a way to do it right, where they can control over 1.5 billion people. And that's the sort of system that we want here in the United States. I'm sorry to say it's coming, but maybe we can do something about it. Hey, listen, if you like this show, share it. It only takes 2 seconds. The algorithms are not our friends. They're not gonna support this sort of information getting out there. So it's up to you, and I really do appreciate it. And if you want to connect with the show, you can do so through the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.